Hi, welcome to episode 28 of Talk About the Passion. I'm your host, Christian Campagna, and hey, it's been a while, hasn't it? How was your summer? You go swimming? Go to a couple cookouts? Throw the frisbee around or what? That's nice. Anyway, I took a couple of months off from doing this podcast for various reasons, and now we're back. No big deal, right? I hope to continue to bring you more good content, and so far I think I will. I have 3 new episodes recorded, and all of them are great. 3 men from different areas of entertainment. All interesting guys with great stories, and I'm proud of all 3 episodes. With that said, my guest today is Robert Fusco, and the episode is called The Inner Mounting Flame, which was named after a Mahavishnu orchestra record. And I think it fits the conversation I had with Robert well. This was my first time meeting Rob. I know his fiance and knew his band One King Down's music, but that was about it. Moving forward with these new episodes, I'd rather just let you discover what happens rather than run down a list of things we talked about. With that said, though, there's this running theme throughout the conversation I had with Rob, and that's about cathartic experiences on, you know, on a small private level, and then, you know, in a live music setting where you experience something larger than life with a group of people, either in the audience or, you know, from the stage as a performer. Rob talks about a particular show by the band Coalesce that changed his world. And the way he described the show reminded me of, I guess it was the second time I saw Corrosion of Conformity, which was August 10th, 1985, at a church in Cambridge, Massachusetts, with this band Executioner, PTL Club, and Postmortem. These were all local bands that probably not household names outside of New England, but all good bands. And Executioner particularly was a metal band from around here, and the guitar player, singer Mark Johnson, put together a lot of important shows in around this era, including, I think he did the Samhain show. But a lot of shows that mixed metal and hardcore bands. Anyway, I'm getting off track here. I still have the pink ticket stub for the show somewhere, and I'm going to try to find it, and I'll add it to the Instagram and Facebook page to go with this episode, as I also have a picture of a tuning peg from a guitar that is related to the story Rob tells about the Coalesce show. So, where was I? Oh, yeah, 1985. So, you know, I love COC, at least most of their eras. But this era, right around when Animosity came out, I think if I'm not mistaken, this show was before the album, a couple months. This show, though, they just came out and just destroyed the place. This show was sort of the moment I realized it was okay for me to put an Iron Maiden patch in my jacket that had, you know, Black Flag and Misfits pins all over it. The marriage of hardcore and metal had been sort of bubbling up with punk bands like Discharge and GBH, and then metal bands like Slayer and Metallica. But for whatever reason, Corrosion of Conformity, this particular night did it for me. There's a moment at performances like this when you feel sort of removed from yourself, watching this whole destruction go down and everything sort of around you disappears. And you know, this isn't like a drug thing. It's just when your entire focus is on one intense thing happening in your mind and body, feel it at the same time. Without further sounding like a hippie, let's just get one more thing out of the way and then we'll get to the episode. You can find this podcast on Spotify now. Search for Talk About the Passion podcast. Make sure you add podcast or else you'll have to listen to the REM song, which is fine. And then I'm also on the normal places like iTunes, Google Play, and all those podcast engines. I'm on social media. Instagram and Facebook have the most up-to-date action. So just search for Talk About the Passion podcast there, and you should be able to find me. If you can't, you shouldn't be allowed to use the internet. Also, if you or someone you know or love would like to be on a future episode, please contact me via one of those social media outlets, and we'll set something up. So let's do this. Welcome back to Talk About the Passion. I'm glad to be doing these again. Here is episode 28, and thanks for listening. So here I am here with Robert Fusco, yes, or sir. However you'd like to pronounce it.
Fusco. Go fuck yourself.
How you doing today, man?
Things are awesome. Thanks for joining me in our home.
Yeah, thanks for having me out here. It's pretty cool.
How was your burrito?
It was great. It was great. Thank you. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it.
How's my level?
It's perfect. Yeah, sounds good.
Nice.
So where did you grow up, Robert?
Oh, shit. I'm still growing up. I'm a 42-year-old, 15-year-old.
Yeah.
I was born in Albany, New York in the 1870s.
Yeah.
And grew up in a small town just south of Saratoga Springs, New York, called Mechanicville.
Okay.
Or Mechanicville.
Yeah.
Michelle breaks my balls because I pronounce it Mechanicville.
Yeah.
And it was as small as it sounds, 1 square mile of straight up either white trash ignorance,
yeah,
or mafioso exclusivity.
Yeah, yeah.
I grew up 2 houses down from the Luciano family.
Oh, okay.
As in the Luciano family.
Okay.
You know, Lucky Luciano.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
These were my neighbors, and, you know, sometimes when the family would fall on hard times, as it was in the, you know, 70s, like the gas crisis of 74 or whatever, mm-hmm. or, you know, when things would take a downturn, mm-hmm. There were multiple resources upon which my family could draw, just down the street.
Right.
But I like plausible deniability. I'm like, don't know, don't want to know, don't give a shit.
Right.
So I guess that's where I started growing up.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in my, somewhere in my 20, early 20s, like 20 or 21, I moved to Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Lived on Mission Hill for like 7 years.
Okay.
And then, bounced back and forth between upstate New York and Philadelphia or the main line of Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
New York City. I lived in Brooklyn for a while and worked on Manhattan, the West Village. That was a trip. Mm-hmm. I enjoy that very much.
Yeah.
And then here I am again in New England.
Yeah.
Feeling like home. I love New England. I don't ever want to leave New England, unless it's, you know, like a permanent move to, say, the Pacific Northwest or someplace,
right.
You know, that I enjoy, but
right.
Yeah, I like New England very much.
Yeah.
Friends are like family here, and
yeah,
it's the winters are brutal, which I love. B R V T A L.
Yeah, I think that gives us all character up here, like
100%, because we, you know, it galvanizes you.
Yeah.
You know, you either, you know, you shovel your fucking driveway,
yeah,
or you don't drive, or you don't
exactly.
drive, you don't go to work, you don't eat.
Yeah.
It's that simple. So
yeah.
I think there's a particular flavor of personality that comes from the Northeast
yeah.
U.S. that
oh, yeah.
you don't really find
yeah.
Any place else in the country.
Yeah. I had I lived in L.A. for a little while, and I had a job interview.
Oh, fuck that.
And my dad lives there.
Mm-hmm.
And when I showed up, the woman said, so-and-so who was interviewed, you was going to be a little late because of the rain. And I remember thinking, like,
it
never
rain.
Fucking rained. But it was such little rain that I don't even think I put my windshield wipers on. And I'm thinking, like, it was the winter after, it was a few months after the winter we had here, where it was like 2014, where there was, like,
absolute.
180 inches or whatever.
Yeah,
it was
obscene.
Yeah, something like... I had to like shovel for fucking 5 hours,
to
get out of my fucking driveway to go to work.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
This lady can't fucking make it to, you know,
because rain.
Yeah, and even if it was pouring rain, you can't fucking drive. Yeah, so
come on.
So that whole vibe is just different from how we are here.
Yes, a lot of people on the West Coast just piss me off. Just like snap out of it.
Yeah,
come
yeah.
on. It's a fucking fantasy land. Like, oh, it's raining. Fuck you.
I know it's rain. Yeah.
You know, fuck you.
Yeah. Whatever. It's so growing up in Albany, how did you get into music up there?
Well, I grew up listening to all sorts of stuff,
yeah.
like even from a very young age. Michelle and I were talking about, you know, the stuff that I was listening to as a boy. And we had a lot of vinyl in the house, and it was
yeah.
either like Donna Summer and Criss Cross and ABBA and all this other fucking trash,
yeah.
or it was Shostakovich
mm-hmm.
or Gershwin or Bach.
Yeah.
And I opted for the latter.
Yeah.
So I began to kind of fall in love with music and how it made me feel, mm-hmm. And what it would do for me as an escapist device,
yeah.
very early on. Mm-hmm. And from there, seven or eight, I started listening to Iron Maiden,
yeah.
And you know, a lot of the larger metal acts of the day, like you know, early Metallica. You know, the only four albums they ever wrote.
Yeah, yeah.
Not
yeah.
the first four. Yeah. The only four.
Yeah.
You know, because everything from Black Album on is just a cover band doing, yeah, you know, yeah. just shitty,
yeah,
you
course.
Know, whatever. So I fell in love with sound
yeah.
itself and with music and, you know, just what it would do for me, both emotionally and psychologically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at a very early age. So from there, you know, metal kind of segued into the first Suicidal Tendencies album,
yeah.
You know, Sick of It All's Blood, Sweat, and No Tears.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like no one showed me these things. I just yeah. went to the record store
yeah.
and just found something that looked pissed off or
right,
like had
right.
song titles that sounded pissed off that,
yeah.
that kind of like echoed what was happening, you know, in my own young life.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that I was just like compiling classic after classic without even realizing
right,
it.
Right.
So that was actually very, you know, a huge fortunate turn of events that I would find so many amazing bands and
yeah.
incredible albums
right.
right out of the gate. So yeah. I consider myself really lucky.
Yeah. And so, were you a big reader too? You strike me as someone who probably reads a lot. And
readers are leaders.
Yeah,
yeah, I read constantly.
Yeah,
you know, and then even as a young boy, I was I moved on from Charlie Brown encyclopedias, which I loved,
yeah.
to like you know, the dictionary. I would keep the dictionary with me
yeah.
all the time. I was fascinated
mm-hmm.
that there were, you know, there were other words I didn't know, and
right.
I had to know what they meant
yeah.
and how to use them in sentences.
Right.
so from there, I would start reading like early Stephen King.
Yeah.
Like I think as a kid, I read Christine and Cujo maybe like four or five times.
Oh yeah.
Each
mm-hmm.
Pet Sematary I read like two or three times
yeah
and then you know finding poetry even as like an early teen
mm-hmm.
Most especially Charles Simic
mm-hmm.
who is a Yugoslav expat who moved to the States in the 70s, and he's now professor emeritus at University of New Hampshire, I think. Yeah.
Huh.
He's like a poet laureate and 1990, I think, prize winner. Was it Pulitzer?
Mm-hmm.
I think. But, you know, writers like that who were boundless and just super creative, and they wanted to do is get an idea across with irresistible imagery.
Right.
I was really drawn to that kind of that kind of stuff, that
yeah.
style, and then you know, getting into a bit more kind of bizarre prose, like House of Leaves by Mark Danielewski.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I loved that book. And,
yeah.
and all of Danielewski's stuff is really kind of out there. He's terrifyingly
yeah.
smart. He's way too clever for his own good.
Yeah, right.
and then somewhere in the mix, I discovered Henry Miller
mm-hmm.
and read Henry Miller like it was my job to do
yeah.
so.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, you know, I defy anyone to find anything more visceral than, you know, Tropic of Cancer, Black Spring, and Air Conditioned Nightmare,
mm-hmm.
you know, which, like, go read them and then we can talk.
Right.
I remember living in Albany with one of my best friends, Josh Turner. He and I were roommates. Mm-hmm. And we grew up on the same street in
okay.
Mechanicville, you know,
yeah.
so we had a similar experience. We both had love for writing and mm-hmm. books, and, you know, and music. And he was a very successful frontman
yeah.
himself, you know, bands like, Wrath and Hope and Parasite,
mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, Host and Parasite. And then, what the hell else did he do? He did, a couple black metal you
yeah.
know, projects, but his voice just, he sounds like a bear caught in a trap. He's amazing. But anyway, we were roommates, and I remember being super, you know, broke. I was down to my last 10 bucks, and on Lark Street, up the street from where Josh and I lived, there was a bookstore called Bryn Mawr. Mm-hmm. And just down the street from there was Shades of Green. It was like this this vegan vegetarian spot where you can get like, you know, smoothies and sandwiches and soup or whatever.
Right.
And I was super hungry. I hadn't eaten in a long time. And I was like, I had my last $10.
Yeah.
And I was going to get some, you know, soup and sandwich. And, you know, I was going to get full for the day. And it was going to be awesome. And, of course, I walked by Bryn Mawr.
Yeah.
And then I walked back to Bryn Mawr and then walked into Bryn Mawr. And found first edition Henry Miller's Black Spring, first edition, for $10.
Really?
They didn't know what they had.
Right, right.
And I was like, do I want to eat or do I want to buy and read Black Spring? Let me go ahead and not think about that at all.
Yeah.
And I said to the guy, I'm like, look, I only have $10. Can you skip the tax? He's like, okay. Right. So I walked out of there and then walked up to the park and spent the rest of the day reading.
Nice.
So the very short answer to that ridiculously long and needlessly long answer, which I'm it's a terrible habit of mine just to give super long answers. So yes, I like to read.
Yeah. And although, was that the same with music? Did you just sort of discover stuff on your own?
100%. I became almost obsessed with trying to see what else was out there.
Right.
Because I remember discovering Mahavishnu Orchestra and Alan Holdsworth and all these weird kind of like proggy jazz type type bands. And all I wanted to do was figure out what else there was.
Yeah.
Because these people were otherworldly. Like Alan Holdsworth. Before Alan Holdsworth, no one sounded like him. After Alan Holdsworth, everyone sounded like him. If you want a perfect example, look at Meshuggah's entire career. Meshuggah based their entire non-heavy sound on Alan Holdsworth's stuff. Like, look at 16 Men of Tain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one of the best albums ever written in that genre. And that and Metal Fatigue and Road Games. Just listen to them and listen to Meshuggah.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, that's where they got
where
it
that from. Came
from
me, yeah.
Exactly. So, I went on this kind of mission to see who was really making the most fucked up noise and who was really pushing the envelope and kind of expanding the boundaries of what was possible within the context of sound.
Yeah.
You know, like Frank Zappa.
Yeah.
You know, even now in a more modern context, you have bands like Animals as Leaders.
Yeah.
You know, the stuff Tosin is doing is amazing.
Yeah.
But then, okay, you have other real weird bands like Wolf Eyes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, like, I was obsessed with noise
for
a while. Not kind of like that spacey, unfocused kind of, you know, garbage. I'm talking about Stabbed in the Face or Black Vomit or, Burn Your House Down, shit like that, off of like Human Animal or Burned Mind, where you heard something that felt like you wanted to kill yourself and everyone else at the same time. Like whenever I would I'd be in the gym and I'd have to set a PR or I had to put myself in that place mentally that I didn't go very often because it was really taxing, but that was my go-to stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I would tap into that and it would charge something up that was so visceral and so feral.
Yeah.
That I knew where to find it.
Yeah.
You know, and I knew how to get there. And like bands like Wolf Eyes or A Fire in the Head, that was how to get to where I needed to be.
Yeah.
So it's as much a utilitarian vehicle as it was for kind of the hedonism.
Yeah. After getting into sort of the hardcore stuff, you started going to shows, obviously, up in Albany. Is that?
Yeah, I started going to shows, I think, when I was 11 or 12, something along those lines. It was wild, you know, before I even knew how to kind of process what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going to like punk and hardcore punk shows, people razor dancing and dancing with billy clubs and people just freaking out. And there was so much blood. Every show there was blood.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, at a very young age, made me, it did something transformative. Mm-hmm. It deepened my response to life.
Yeah.
Because I was in an environment that was unsafe. And every time I left a show alive, you know, it was like life, it was life affirming.
Yeah.
That was some Rick and Morty shit right there.
I know, right?
Morty. So being in an environment, excuse me, that was like inherently dangerous.
Yeah.
Heightens your awareness.
Yeah.
It makes your vision sharp. It makes your hearing sharp. Everything, you feel alive. Your eyes are massive.
Yeah, yeah.
Because what do you know? There could be some fucking skinhead,
right,
you know, coming at you from nowhere, or some some dude who decided to jump off the speaker rig and crush your skull.
Yeah.
Or somebody would start a fight with you.
Yeah.
For no reason.
Yeah.
Other than they were all cranked up.
Yeah,
and they wanted a fist fight.
Yeah.
And I've had my share of those fist fights.
Yeah.
And as fun as they were, I would prefer not to, you know. So, yeah, it was really, really wild very early on. And it was the best fucking time of my life. Like, I never want to go back there, but I never want to not have experienced
have
it. You know, I never want that to be taken away. Because that's part of what made me really appreciate being alive.
Yeah.
You know, people go to, you know, concerts and they go to these venues and everything's sterile and they have their seat number and they take their seat and they watch the show and they clap and they go home.
Yeah.
But our experience growing up in mortal peril.
Yeah.
Willfully putting ourselves in harm's way in these really volatile pressure cooker situations, surrounded by these volatile misanthropes, by these like malcontents who have no filter and there's just no leash.
Yeah,
it's amazing. Yeah. It's so chaotic, and somehow from this chaos comes an order.
Yeah,
you know. I learned more about sociology and about human nature within the first like few months of going to shows than I have since combined.
Yeah.
I started going to shows very early, and I'm glad of that because I got to experience some really hairy shit, you know? Yeah.
And you think up there was more violent than any other sort of areas of the country you've been?
I don't know. I know it. All I know is what I saw.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, you hear stories, mm-hmm. but, you know, if you don't see, you don't believe.
Right.
But then, okay, once I got to, like, say, Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
And I saw how violent those kids were, I believed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Jesus fucking Christ. Yeah, like, yeah. Salt Lake City, Cleveland, you know, Albany. Where else? Like some parts of like New York City and Jersey.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the parts of Jersey that weren't taken over by like, you know, Wigger Slam Corps, whatever.
Right,
like,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
But people who were just feral.
Yeah. Yeah.
People who were feral. Yeah. They were barely human.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and we were all coming together to celebrate this catharsis.
Yeah.
You know, because what the fuck else were we gonna do?
Yeah.
What else were we gonna do?
Right.
And we all put ourselves in this, you know, time bomb of a social setting. It was amazing.
Yeah.
So it was real, real violent, and it taught everyone quite a lot. And not all the lessons were the same.
Right. Right.
You know, everyone came away with something a bit different.
Yeah.
There was a lot of blood.
And did you start identifying with straight edge from the hardcore scene, or were you always?
Well, even before I knew what straight edge was, I identified with the ideology, but that's how I lived. But I didn't discover what straight edge was as an ethos until, you know, maybe after having lived that way for a year or two, it just never appealed to me.
Right.
You know, escapist tendencies, escapist devices it wasn't attractive.
Yeah, and you could find it in music and books and everything else.
Exactly, so. Right. Or, you know, or chess, you know.
Right.
Chess is like the ultimate escapist device.
Mm-hmm.
If you do it properly, it demands 100% of you.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was, you know, I discovered what straight edge was. And, you know, developmentally speaking, from a developmental perspective, to find something to cling to and having a flag to wave at that stage in my life, 16, 17, whatever, it was super important to have something with which I could identify and to have like a, you know, structure.
Yeah.
Nowadays, okay, having, you know, established my personality for the most part, it's not quite as critical because I know who I am as a person.
Right. Yeah.
But I see, you know, people clinging onto a thing. And when are people likely to cling? When they're in a panic. Yeah. If you're out at sea and you're drowning and someone throws you a preserver, you cling to it.
Yeah.
Similar, people will cling to something that they think is going to get them from point A to point B or help them survive or what have you. So, you know, there were these ideas at work and, you know, I identified with them. And then all of a sudden, it became its own thing. And I had, okay, then I had a flag to wave and I could... Yeah. I could tell somebody, okay, well, here's what I am.
Right.
You know, I was able to identify, you know, like you do in high school. Oh, what are you? Are you a headbanger? Are you a skater?
Yeah.
Are you a jock? Are you a preppy or whatever? Right. It smacked of that. But, you know, as we mature and as we kind of understand the nature of reality and human nature itself, then, okay, you can relax your grip on it.
Right.
Because you don't need to carry the card and show everyone who never asks.
Yeah, exactly.
You
know?
So that's where I was at that age.
Yeah. And so what era? You said you're 42, so this would have been like late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, early 90s. Late 80s, early 90s. Jesus Christ. Yeah. My hip is trying to replace itself just having
thinking about
just
it. Yeah. So when did you start getting into performing?
Well, you know, 16, 17, I would do like spoken word and, you know, poetry intros for bands or whatever.
Oh, really?
Because I enjoyed that kind of that idea.
Yeah.
And I wanted to have a microphone. I wanted to be loud.
Yeah.
I wanted to be loud and heard.
Yeah.
And not even because I believed in what I had written or the message or whatever, because a lot of the stuff just came off the top of my head anyway.
Yeah.
I wanted to be on stage. I wanted to have a microphone in my hand. And you know, when my old best pal Billy, who was the OG singer for One King Down, when he split, he was in trouble with the law for graffiti. You know, the natural, it just seemed natural for me to try out, and I was friends with everyone already, and they're like, okay, well, you know, here, learn these songs, sing these songs, or whatever. And I wrote a lot of stuff anyway, because like sometimes in the studio, I'd be hanging out with Billy, and he's like, I need lyrics for a song. I'm like, dude, I just rip a page right out of my notebook, and like, here, see if these work. These will work.
Nice.
So it seemed very natural and organic. So I started singing for One King Down, and we wrote Bloodlust Revenge, and the rest is history.
Right. And do you remember the first time you got on stage, like singing, what that was like?
Yeah, it was bizarre, but it felt natural.
Yeah.
It simultaneously felt like surreal, but like I had done it for years and years anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, you know, you find your voice over the course of, you know, however many shows or years. So at first, okay, there were some awkward but important first steps.
Yeah.
And then, okay, once we got rolling, I began to kind of really be very, very comfortable performing in front of people and started to engage the crowd more and, you know, banter back and forth with Woody, with Matt Wood.
Mm-hmm.
That's when things really started getting a hell of a lot more fun for everybody, you know, because we were in our element. We were finding our voice, finding the groove. And I think that confidence translated very well, you know, in a live setting. So that's that.
And do you think you got the same sort of feeling you got when you would go to shows, like as a, you know, younger, when, you know, that same sort of danger and like,
I think so. I mean, it's difficult to say. I know that there were times when performing, my intent was to impart the same feeling of, you know, white knuckle terror that I experienced, you know, going to shows, whether or not I was like, it was a floor show and I just like, I learned this trick from Seth Putnam.
Yeah.
I would like sprint with the mic cord around the left side of the venue, cut back across the room near merch and then sprint back towards the band and try to lasso as many people as I could. Or I'd wrap the mic cable around somebody's face.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I'd get a handful of somebody's hair and would not let go. and it wasn't like I was being malicious.
Right.
I was just caught up in it. Yeah, I was living the moment, man, you know, and you know, I still do some stuff like that to this day.
Yeah.
It's just that energy. It's indescribable. Yeah. It's completely unexplainable to anyone who hasn't lived it or experienced it. You can't convey it conversationally.
Yeah,
you know, to your normie types.
Right. Yeah.
If you've lived it and you know it, you got that kind of knowing.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Because if you took if I took half of the people I work with to like a hardcore show.
Oh my God.
And you were doing that, they would be like, I can't. What is it? Is this guy? You know.
What's wrong with that? Is he on a drug holiday? Like, geez.
Yeah. I feel like anytime singers like that exist, it was always just added to the show. And I think
100%, because I remember Really Loud Music Fest, which would go on to become New England Metal and Hardcore Festival. Really Loud Music Fest, 1999, Pearl Street, Northampton, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
One King Down played. It was like Ire and Converge and Project Kate. Fuck out of here. Whatever. Yeah. Kate's always been nice to us. Whatever. And then Coalesce.
Yeah.
I thought Ire was fucking incredible.
Yeah.
I Discern an Overtone of Tragedy in Your Voice was like, if it weren't for dude's voice being a little bit like hollow, that would have been a top 10 album for me, because the whole thing is fucking desperate. Like precursor to like doom metal. It's almost like doom hardcore somehow. Mm-hmm. Like Funeral sounding. It was very, almost like later Motive stuff from Long Island, you know?
Yeah.
Funny enough, I have a straight edge anime girl tattoo done on my leg by Al, ex Motive, who died of a heroin overdose. Jeez. And that tattoo was done somewhere in Ohio at a house party after One King Down played with VOD at the Grog Shop.
Oh Jesus.
It was just fucking, it was surreal. And then and the girl who owned the house, she was getting banged by like three of the dudes in VOD at the same time. It was like and I was downstairs getting tattooed by this, you know, this straight edge guy who would go on to do heroin, get a fucking hot shot and peace out. But anyway, where was I? Yeah, Coalesce, really, really loud music fest, Northampton, Mass, 99. I have seen a lot of shows. I have played a lot of shows. And so few have left as deep an impact, a scar across my psyche, as Coalesce did that day.
Yeah.
You see a show and you're like, oh, so that's what's possible now.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it took it from, you know, you go from 2 to 3 to 3 to 4. No. It cranked it right to 11, Spinal Tap style.
Yeah.
I've never in my life seen something so chaotic, so violent, and sound so good.
Yeah, yeah.
And the crowd of animals were destroying each other.
Yeah.
And Coalesce was destroying each other and destroying everything they owned.
Yeah.
And they're breaking everything. And I remember Jess taking his guitar, holding it overhead, and spiking his guitar's headstock into the stage. And one of his tuning pegs spiraled to rest at my feet.
Yeah.
I scooped it up, put it in my pocket, and I have it to this day.
Oh, really?
That's awesome. I'll show it to you.
Nice.
Hang on one second.
Yeah. Oh, look at that. That's fucking crazy. That's amazing.
Isn't that sick?
That's awesome.
Yeah. So this came spiraling to
Can
rest.
Can I take a picture of that?
Please.
Yeah.
This came spiraling to rest at my feet. And I scooped it up and put it in my pocket.
Yeah.
And I keep this with me.
Yeah.
And it is a reminder that what you think is possible is wrong.
Yeah.
Because something else is always, you know, you can always go beyond.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen anything like that in my life. And from that moment on, I was like, well, I guess I'm going to have to step it up.
Yeah.
I guess I'm going to have to step it up a bit. And I did. other such shows that left similar impressions. I can't think of many.
Yeah, Dead Guy. The first time I saw
that. Oh yeah, Dead Guy played that. Dead Guy played that. Yeah. Same. It was a Dead Guy cover band.
Okay, yeah.
Basically,
yeah,
it was you know, Tim. Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, Tim wasn't involved, and yeah. I'm a huge fan of all things.
Yeah.
Tim Singer.
Yeah.
He was a very real person.
Oh yeah.
And we got to play with Kiss It Goodbye too.
Yeah.
In a shitty fucking stained basement in Connecticut, or whatever. And right. That's another one of those sets where it's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
I've never seen so few people make so much noise.
Yeah.
And just destroy it. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. When you see those shows, it definitely, especially as a performer, makes you just want to not be better than that, but just
to be better than than
just,
you were.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And just sort of embody that sort of passion and energy and suck it in. And do what you do.
Yeah, 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 exactly, exactly. Like, you'd be the Kirby of aggression, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, seeing things like that inspire you.
Yeah.
To not be, yeah, like you said, not be better than them, but be better than you.
Yeah, yeah.
You want to be better or more violent or more aggressive or louder or more ripped or whatever than you are.
Yeah.
You're inspired. Inspired is one of my favorite words.
Yeah.
I have it tattooed on me.
Do you?
Yeah, I'll show you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the main idea is you see things like that and you're like, wow, that's possible.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah.
You know, ratchet it up.
Now, did you take, obviously, because you're talking about listening to classical music and reading.
Yeah.
Now, would you take influences from that and put it into your lyrics and just, you know, how you perform as a hardcore singer?
Yeah, I mean, I never really think of myself as a hardcore singer.
Right.
I just try to you know, how do I put it? Abide by the truth of the moment, you know, figure out what the moment is asking for and just give it hell.
Yeah.
100%. So the answer is yes, I would take, you know, bits and pieces from everything I see and everything I hear and try to take the best parts of these elements, the sharpest, hardest elements of these performances and these musicians, and just forge it into something, and then let it loose.
Yeah.
But there's some subtlety there as well. Like, for instance, if you look at old footage of Glenn Gould playing piano.
Yeah.
He's and like I said, I try to mention him in every interview I do.
Yeah.
I don't use the term genius often, but the man was a genius.
Yeah.
He was a musical genius.
Yeah.
Of the highest order.
Yeah.
He would perform in that chair, not unlike this one. This is like a rickety old chair. He would never use a piano bench.
Really?
And he would sing to his instrument as he played it. And then he would close his eyes and be completely, like, from the chest up, be completely divorced from what was happening from the elbows down.
Yeah.
He was enraptured. He displayed this bizarre, otherworldly, clinical ecstasy that you have to see to believe.
Yeah.
You know, and his hands were doing just inhuman things.
Yeah, yeah.
He played Bach's Goldberg Variations front to back off of the top of his head.
Yeah.
I'm going to say it again. He played all of Bach's Goldberg Variations off of the top of his head. And he was just either singing to his piano, or his head was back.
Yeah.
And he was like daydreaming.
Right.
And I took that and I tried as hard as I could to understand it.
Yeah.
And to somehow translate it to our craft, to what we were doing.
Yeah.
And I'm still searching.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to figure it out. And I may never figure it out. I'm doubtful that I will, but it's there and I'm focused on it. And at least it is guiding me in a direction that I think is worthwhile.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting enough to explore.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm going to continue to do that. And so, yeah, I pull bits and pieces from everywhere and try to emulate and embellish and just do the best I can do.
Yeah.
Not necessarily for the people who are watching, but for me.
Yeah, yeah. You know? For, like, heavy music Who are some of your go-to guys, like, for vocalists?
Oh, shit. See, there's two ways I approach that.
Yeah.
Lyrical and vocal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Lyrically, it's entirely contingent on my mood.
Yeah.
Like, I could listen to Abandon, you know, and that dude had, you know, for that style of music, perfect blend of, like, ultra depressed lyrics, and his voice was just he was an absolute abomination.
Yeah.
But then I would listen to even newer, like Vincent, and what he did with the Acacia Strain, like Grave Bloom, is, and I'm not just saying it because I'm on it, I'm saying that album is near perfect.
Yeah.
And the stuff that Vincent does, I mean, I've always been a fan of his voice anyway. He just makes it look very easy. It's effortless. You know, the stuff that he's done, I've always been a fan of. Mike Williams of I Hate God.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up listening to I Hate God, and and that band, you want to talk about a paradigm shift.
Yeah.
Hearing Dope Sick for the first time, again, it was like seeing Coalesce.
Yeah.
Like, changed my whole shit up, where, like, oh, this is possible now.
Yeah. All
right. And then Take As Needed for Pain happened. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Oh, fuck. Again?
Yeah.
Come on. I'm just trying to catch up.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to catch up to Dope Sick.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that Mike was, like, an exceptionally talented vocalist. He was good at what he did.
Yeah.
But he had this kind of bizarre creativity that could only come from, like, apathy.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's like, well, I don't give a fuck. Just give me heroin.
The vibe that band embodies is so fucking intense. Every little bit of it, the artwork, the what they look like, the music, the lyrics, is just...
Agreed.
It's just fucking...
Agreed. Some of my best friends, you know, Rob and Cleary and Craig from Philadelphia, we all went to Johnny Brenda's and saw I Hate God, and it was... It was, again, another one of those transformative experiences. I'm like, Jesus fucking Christ, you know, singing along and jumping on people. It was amazing.
Yeah.
But then there were times when I would stare at Jimmy Bauer playing guitar with my jaw in my lap.
Yeah.
I'm like, you got to be fucking kidding me, right?
Yeah.
And it was one of the most surreal moments of my life when I was like, hanging out, and Mike was walking around looking at merch, and I came up to him like, oh, hey, you know, my name's Rob, we have friends in common, Ren Rasmini of Starkweather says to say hello. He's like, oh yeah, Renny, how's he doing? Whatever, you know. And then Jimmy Bauer comes over, and we're chopping it up, and they're looking at me, and Jimmy goes, yeah, you're that guy from Most Precious Blood. And you want to talk about,
right?
You know, in cinema where the camera zooms in on somebody but pulls back at the same time.
Yeah. Yep.
That happened to me.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, oh,
right.
Yeah, that's. Oh my God, that's me, right? Yeah. And then Jimmy tried to pass me a joint, and I was like, yeah, no, thanks, I'm all right, dude. You know, and I told my friends, I'm like, dude, if I were to ever break edge, Jimmy Bauer would be the dude to do it. And I was in the situation and he tried to pass the joint. I'm like, nah, no thanks. Fuck. I can't do it. It's like when Igor Cavalera came up to me after our set, where were we? Waldrock Fest, or with Full Force. I forget. It was like, us and Type O Negative and Pete and I actually became really good friends. I had a whole bunch of stories.
Yeah.
That's fucking ridiculous.
Yeah.
And Sepultura and Cradle of Filth and Motorhead, I think. Yeah, Motorhead.
Yeah.
So Igor ran up to me after our set, and he was like, oh, man, that was incredible. You guys were amazing. You know, where are you from? Tell us about, you know, whatever, this and that. And my inside voice, my inside voice was like, oh, my God, it's Igor Cavalera. Fuck. But then my outside voice said, oh, cool. Thanks, man. Who are you?
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was like, who are you? He's like, oh, man. And he was like attitude free.
Yeah,
he was like, oh, man, my name's Igor.
That's awesome.
I'm like, that's cool, man. What are you doing merch for somebody here or what? You know? And he's like, and he wasn't offended. He was like, no, man, I play drums for Sepultura. I'm like, oh, yeah, cool, man. Yeah, I've been into your stuff for a long time. I'm a huge fan, you know? Yeah. And meanwhile, my inside voice is like, oh, my God, right? I remember seeing them. It was January 24th, 1994 at Saratoga Winners in upstate New York. And it was Fudge Tunnel, Fear Factory,
yeah,
Clutch, and Sepultura.
I saw that in Providence. Yeah.
No shit.
Yeah, Fudge Tunnel was a fucking great band too.
That was fucking great. Yeah. Fear Factory, I could take or leave, And Clutch, they put on a good show, but outside of Shogun, it was like, whatever.
Yeah.
But Sepultura just fucking laid it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
But here I was standing there talking to fucking Igor Cavalera, breaking his balls, like, without that's him amazing. Knowing him, you know, shit. Yeah. And I was like, oh, yeah, cool, man. Who are you? You know,
that's
so
amazing.
We exchanged information you know, we stayed in touch for a long time. Awesome. He's a total sweetheart.
So you said Pete Steele, you.
Yeah. We became buddies because, like, we'd be playing a bunch of festivals together. So I introduced myself in catering.
Mm-hmm.
I walked up. I said, hey, Pete, my name is Rob. You know, we're playing some shows together. I figured I'd introduce myself. And he's like, Rob, very nice to meet you. Join me, won't you? And he was surrounded by, like, 7 or 8 of the most beautiful women in the world.
Yeah.
And he said, ladies, won't you excuse us, please? Right? And without a fucking word, all of these women just stood up and filed
scattered.
The fuck out.
That's amazing.
And just left me there with Pete
and
our dinner trays or whatever.
Yeah.
And so from there, like, he was, like, genuinely interested in who I was and what I had to say.
Nice.
And likewise, right?
Yeah.
And I'd been a fan of his stuff since Slow, Deep, and Hard.
Yeah, yeah.
So we got along famously, immediately.
Yeah.
And from there, every time we'd be playing together, either he would be in our green room or I'd be in theirs.
Yeah.
Although I would always prefer he be in ours because someone would always piss on the floor in theirs, you know, or it'd be a fucking mess.
I'm not,
But probably the most intelligent dude I've ever met on tour, like, easily one of the nicest, most generous,
humble,
just very, very intelligent.
Yeah.
And we would have hours long conversations about everything from, like, medieval European history to, like, you know, why amps in the United States hum at F because 60 cycles per second, and why in Europe they hum at B flat because of 50 cycles per second, right? You know, and everything in between.
Yeah.
And anecdotally, he's like,
Rob, let me tell you a story. I'm the only person in the history of my Brooklyn high school to ever fail music.
I'm like, no shit, right? And, you know, he told a story. He was over at Phil's house in Louisiana.
Yeah.
And he's like, he was on the third floor balcony, and in Phil's backyard, there's a giant pool.
Yeah.
It's a white pool with a giant black pentagram at the bottom of it. You can see it. And they're on, like, the third floor balcony, and he's like,
you think I could make it from here?
You know, like, and then Phil was like, hold on, let me get my camera. You know, he went and got a camcorder, and by the time Phil got back to the porch, Pete was stark naked, standing on the banister, and then, you know, Phil started filming, and Pete jumped off and landed on the floor of the pool where the shallow end became the deep end.
And he's like, I tell you what, Rob, I've never before in my life felt like I was going to shit and vomit at the same time.
I'm like, oh, I can imagine. You hit the deck from fucking 3 stories, pal. You dipshit.
It's amazing.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I have, like, myriad stories like that. You know, some of them I star in. But Pete was real, real nice.
That's cool.
I was real sad to see him go.
Yeah, I know, right?
You know, but we all make our own choices.
Of course.
You know, we play stupid games, win stupid prizes.
Yeah, of course. So you did touring. Did you like touring much?
No, I didn't enjoy touring. I didn't tour well.
Yeah.
You know, it's not because I disliked the rigors of the road. I didn't mind it.
Mm-hmm.
I knew what I was signing up for.
Yeah.
It was just real difficult because I was just homesick all the time.
Yeah.
I was sick constantly.
Yeah.
Never really ate well. But then again, that's tour, right?
Right. Sleeping on floors. And
Sleeping on floors. I would. There's a picture going around of me now with a shirt from like the 90s. It just says Cubby Hole.
Yeah.
And I if I recall right, it's because I would always find some place to sleep that was like underneath a sink or under a table. I'd try and climb into that liquor cabinet or whatever, you know, and just and curl up into a ball and wish for death.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So touring was okay because, you know, you get to see the world, you get to see all sorts of shit, and you really get to see what humans are like and how they live for real. I think it was Anais Nin has a quote, speaking of writers and the Henry Miller connection. She said, "The world shrinks in proportion to your courage."
Yeah.
And she's exactly right. She was exactly right. The more courageous we got, the more of the world we saw, the smaller every other town became, the smaller the town you came from became.
Yeah.
I remember even just traveling, you know, the States a few times and then coming back to see how small town America, how small it really was how backwards everyone was and how fucked up everyone thought.
Yeah.
You know, it was a rude awakening.
Yeah.
But it also made me very thankful that, you know, we had the energy and the drive to get out there and see everything and lay waste to as many people as we could and then, you know, get coffee at the Eiffel Tower, or go to a koala sanctuary in Australia and just see all this cool shit and visit Cape Town, you know, South Africa, get shot at. We got shot at in South Africa.
Really?
Yeah, we had just pulled up. It was Most Precious Blood, and we had just pulled into Durban from Johannesburg. And Joburg is a fucking nightmare.
Yeah.
It's like beyond Thunderdome.
Yeah.
Like the whole fucking city is like beyond Thunderdome. I'm like, you got to be shitting me.
Yeah.
Get me the fuck out of here immediately, if not sooner.
Right.
So we were like, okay, we're going to Durban. We get some Indian food. It was a main spice trading port, so that all the Indian food is real good.
Yeah.
So we pull up in front of this Indian food place, and like maybe 50 meters down the road is a corner store, like a bodega. And we all get out of the van, and we're stretching, and, you know, it's dusk. And a car screeches to a halt in front of this bodega, and this guy gets out of the car and runs in firing rounds at the shopkeeper.
Oh,
just bap, 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 you know. And we see him run out. This guy gets shot in the head.
Yeah.
Right. And this guy runs out with like arms full of stuff and gets in the car and does a U-turn and drives right by us. But the guy running the shop didn't die.
Yeah.
He gets up, pissing blood out of his head with a semi-automatic weapon, and he starts firing rounds at this guy who's driving by us.
Yeah.
We're like, we hit the fucking deck so fast. I was hiding behind a tree. Colin was like ducked, you know, in the van, trying to hide behind the seats. And I think one of us was just standing there like, what's happening? But wow, you want to talk about like, hey, welcome to South Africa, you know?
And then you have to play a show.
And then, right. Here, have some Indian food and then go yell at people.
Yeah, wow.
So yeah, that's, you want to talk about story collecting. That was one for the ages right there.
Yeah.
The baboons. Holy fuck, the baboons in Cape Town. Seeing a sunrise over the African continent, driving overnight from east to west was surreal.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
And then being surrounded by baboons.
Yeah.
Jesus fucking Christ. I don't ever want to. You know, Michelle and I were talking about this not long ago.
Yeah.
I don't ever fucking.
Terrifying.
No.
Yeah.
You think you're a bad motherfucker?
Yeah.
Nope. Nope. Look at those teeth.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. So when you would tour, and, you know, you have like a shitty day, or just, you know, you slept on a floor, so you're probably not feeling fucking good.
Correct.
How were you able to, you know, maintain that night to then was that like automatic for you to like, well, we have a job to do.
Yes.
We need to fuck these people up. And
So
that's just,
it became
natural.
Yeah. It was natural. And it was a matter of just maintaining our professionalism and trying our very best to not take what was happening outside to the stage.
Yeah. Yeah.
But given the nature of our music and the fact that we're not, you know, the Rolling Stones, a certain degree of that is permissible.
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, maybe even helpful.
Helped, yeah, yeah.
Right. So in terms of bodily wear and tear, sometimes it would get a bit dicey because it does grind you.
Yeah.
It does grind you down. But, you know, you find that place where you need to go, and out of nowhere, your body becomes numb and your eyes light up, and that's that.
Yeah.
It's on.
Yeah.
You deal with the consequences after.
After. Yeah,
after. You pay the man after.
Yeah,
right?
Of
course. It's like you're paying two people. You know, the music starts and you're paying the man.
Yeah, yeah.
And then afterwards everything dies down, you cool off.
Yeah.
And then you're paying the man.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So there's some you know, once you're on the road, you find a rhythm, you're able to kind of destroy place after place with metronomic regularity without breaking a sweat.
Yeah, of course.
But everything comes with a price, you know, and no such thing as a free lunch. So you're going to pay one way or the next. And all stress, and there's a lot of stress, all stress is paid for with sleep.
Mm-hmm.
The nervous system can't differentiate between physiological, psychological, and emotional stress. So and you can pay a stalling fee with calories.
Yeah.
Like, you know, my friend Mark says, Mark Twite, he said, you can pay a stalling fee with calories, but ultimately all stress is paid for with sleep.
Yeah.
So you try to do as much sleeping as you can
when
you're in the van, because once you're somewhere where you have to kind of sleep on the floor, you have a hard time falling asleep, because you realize, oh wait, you know, last time I was here I woke up and blew my nose and ant parts came out of my nose, or I woke up and there was a bug
I've never seen before
the size of my fist trying to eat my neck,
right?
You know, or somebody's trying to steal my stuff,
yeah,
or you know, whatever,
right.
Take your pick.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, I mean, it's difficult sometimes depending on your level of general fatigue, but once you get in the moment, it takes over whatever it is, and you just do it.
Yeah.
You just get it done.
Yeah. And how do you differentiate between One King Down and Most Precious Blood? Like, how you would perform as...
Each band I'm in has its own vibe. And it's difficult to elucidate, but I can tell you that Most Precious Blood carried with it a much more bitter kind of feeling.
Mm-hmm.
One King Down was a bit less bitter. I mean, still super pissed off.
Yeah.
But I let loose a ton of venom during my tenure with MPB.
Yeah.
And even in Recon.
Yeah.
There was a lot of venom. I get a feeling when I play with One King Down that's unlike anything, like unlike any band I've done, because I think there's something, you know, really special about those dudes.
Yeah.
And not even those dudes and me. Mm-hmm. I'm not even trying to like count myself in.
Right.
Because I think those guys are on such a different level than me. They're so strong.
Yeah.
And I'm still learning how to do what I do.
Yeah.
But all of those dudes, they're like living legends. They're like incredible musicians and really solid people.
Yeah.
So, to be able to, share the stage with them, and I'm fortunate to call them friends and brothers, is really, I just get really happy.
Yeah.
You know, when I play with them.
Yeah.
Because I feel humbled and super honored. I just feel very, very lucky.
Yeah.
I feel super lucky.
Yeah.
Not to say that, you know, my bandmates in other bands were, you know, are anything less, because everybody brings something of their own to the table.
Yeah.
But I think there's something super bright and very unique. Not very, just unique, because nothing is...
Right.
There are no degrees of unique. Either you're unique or you're not.
Yeah.
But there's something really special about that band.
Yeah.
And I feel, again, super fortunate to be able to hold the mic there.
Yeah. How did the... show that you just did in Philadelphia, how did that come about?
Oh, well,
because you guys hadn't played in
17, almost 18 years.
Yeah.
We released Bloodlust Revenge, re-released it, and
that was last year, right?
Last year. And so we all kind of knew, like, we felt that, okay, if we were gonna play again, the time was coming.
Yeah.
And so I reached out to Joe and he put together an offer and said, hey, how about you do this? I know what the market can bear.
Yeah.
Come play for these people.
Yeah.
They want to see you.
Yeah.
And we were like, well, you know, we got to chalk up a powerful conference.
Yeah.
And we agreed, and we're like, okay, well, let's do it.
Yeah.
Because what's the worst that can happen?
Right. Yeah.
What's the worst thing that can happen?
Right.
fives of kids stick around and the crowd goes mild.
Right, I know, right?
So what?
Yeah.
Whatever. We'll just fight. We'll play a
do
set.
Your thing, yeah.
We'll do our thing. Yeah. If people want to watch and sing along, cool. If they don't, cool. Don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
You know, there to do it.
Yeah.
Not there to care about who cares about us doing it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Know?
So we decided to just pull the pin.
Yeah.
And let it fucking go.
Yeah.
And we did. And we practiced really hard. And even those early practices with which I was, of which I was a part, it felt like no time had passed at all.
Yeah.
It felt as if we had stepped out of the room, gone and gotten something to eat, and then just stepped back into the room and wasn't 17 years later.
Yeah.
It was like no problem.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
And that's like a whole lifetime. I mean, not a lifetime, but that's a
Well,
long
for some people,
time. Yeah.
That's a long it is their
time.
Lifetime.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, like some of the kids who saw us play in Philadelphia, that was their lifetime.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we rang out for the last time 2001 Auckland, New Zealand.
Yeah.
And then some of these people were born.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that fucked up?
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing that, that we're able to kind of span so many generations. And it's really, I mean, maybe it's not a special story, but it's humbling and it's really, it gives me a very particular feeling that I'm having a hard time describing. It's almost like I'm carrying the lantern. We're carrying the lantern, you know, we're lighting the way somehow.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that because we're special or important. I'm just saying like, here's where we were 17 years ago. Here's where we are today.
Yeah.
And here's how it's done.
Yeah.
You know?
Watching the video footage from that, it must be humbling just to see. Yeah, 17 fucking years later.
It's
the like people singing your lyrics and
it's
just
so bizarre. Yeah. Like I never expected that.
Yeah.
Even when One Kingdom was playing all the time, I never expected
it. Right, right.
You know, and then to be welcomed like that.
Right.
It's indescribable.
Yeah.
You know, I wish I had something clever or funny to say, but it's just it's just indescribable when you're looking out at all these furious faces who love what you've done and who love what you're doing.
Yeah.
And you're looking back at them and you love what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
I don't have the vocabulary to properly elucidate the point, but
and like we were saying, like, I don't think hardcore can be described in words or us talking about it or writing it down.
It has to be
it's a cliche that you have to be there, but
you can describe it, but you can't taste it.
Yeah, and you can't feel it. And,
smell you know. It and it's like trying to describe, you know, color to a blind person.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Just go to a show and jump on kids and feel alive, you know? Go do a thing.
Yeah. Are you guys going to play more shows?
Yeah, we have a show, as of right now, we have a show October 6th in Albany, New York.
Oh, cool.
Playing for the hometown crowd. And after that, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if we will play again. I don't know. If we do, cool. If we don't, cool.
Right.
It's just been one goddamn hell of a ride.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd be happy to put a cap on it there.
Right.
But I mean, I know other offers will come in.
Yeah.
And we're in a very good position now to be able to pick and choose what we want to do, how much time we want to spend away from our families and our homes. And the fact is we don't have to. We're not obligated to. It's not what we do to make money anymore.
Right.
You know?
So. Is everyone in the Northeast too?
Everyone's in the Northeast. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Mike lives in Boston.
Yeah.
I live here in Worcester. And then the other 60% live in the Capital District and work for Steve Reddy at Equal Vision Records.
Really?
They all head their departments. Derek is head of screen printing. Matt is head of merch now, and Billy's in charge of the art department.
Oh, like,
it's so funny.
Yeah.
I think Billy was if I'm not mistaken, I think Billy was Equal Vision's first full-time employee.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's amazing.
That's amazing.
No, they're doing great for themselves. Yeah. I'm really, really proud of them.
Yeah.
I'm especially proud of Mike. He's making it in Boston. He and his missus are expecting.
Awesome.
Everyone has beautiful families. they're crushing it right now. I'm so happy for him. I'm so proud of him.
Yeah, and you are too. This is the first time we've met, and I've just known you from Michelle and your fiance.
Yes, that's right.
And so when I saw the live footage, I was like, oh, it's like an angry guy, but like very, you know, just from the vibe, I was like, he seems like a vet, like I've read your lyrics and just, you know, looked up stuff. And I was like, very smart guy. That's kind of why I wanted to reach out.
I appreciate it. I disagree with the whole smart thing. I can't be that smart. I mean, look at me. Shit, I'm barely sentient. But yeah, it's a... What a spot I'm in.
Yeah. No, I feel like you're someone that's got a lot of drive, and it's cool to see that. So
that's most appreciated. And yeah. I'm one of the most pissed off motherfuckers ever lived, but I'm also very, emotionally sensitive.
Right. Well, that was going to be my next question. Like,
I'm sensitive.
So,
shit.
That was going to be my next question. Was like, is this, going to calm you down a little, or you know.
No.
Because yeah.
No. I have to pull back the reins every day.
Yeah, of course.
Because when you grow up,
yeah,
and you set everything on fire.
Yeah.
But then you find yourself in a position where not everything around you responds so well to fire.
Right.
Then you have to learn to temper that impulse.
Yeah.
I wrote a lyric. Upstate Ghost, I think, is the song.
Mm-hmm.
To a man with only a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you're super furious your whole life and all you do is scream at problems and hit problems and rage against problems, anytime a problem that presents itself in your adult life, which requires a more subtle approach,
mm-hmm,
you're not going to be able to solve the problem. Not everything is a Gordian knot.
Right. Yeah.
That a sword will solve.
Right.
You have to sometimes pick at the problem, mm-hmm, with a ton of patience,
yeah,
and with deftness,
yeah,
and with faith that you will solve the problem.
Yeah.
And to try to communicate your ideas in a reasonably lucid fashion, in a calm fashion, and it's not always easy.
Yeah.
Again, you spend your whole life screaming at problems,
right,
and solving them that way, or maybe thinking you're solving them, but maybe you're just like Pete once wrote, it's like painting over dirt. Maybe nothing has ever gotten solved.
Yeah.
Maybe I've just given myself the illusion.
Right.
Right. But how you actually solve problems, you work backwards. You think critically. You back up. You take a larger view and see what requires most
fixing
attention.
Yeah.
Right. You approach it critically.
Mm-hmm.
A former world chess champion,
mm-hmm,
Mikhail Moiseevich Botvinnik,
mm-hmm,
has a quote, and it stuck with me forever. It's for the solving of inexact tasks,
mm-hmm,
it's important to limit the scale of the problem to avoid getting bogged down in it. Only then is there a chance of solving it more exactly.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole quote. And he's right.
Yeah.
If you can zoom out, then you're well positioned to figure out what requires the most attention. But if you are so zoomed in on a thing,
mm-hmm,
you think in such granular terms,
right,
then you will have 0.0 chance of ever, 0.00 repeating, of course, ever solving the problem with any respectable degree of accuracy.
Yeah.
That's how it goes.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you doing this, man. This is has been a lot of fun.
You have tolerated my incessant rambling for I don't know how long. And I talk way too fucking much.
No, it's fine. Yeah, it's fine, man. This has been great.
I appreciate it so much. Yeah. Thank you for having me, and thanks for being in our home and for having Chipotle and eating tiramisu, which I'm gonna have some.
Yeah.
Right now, it's really good. Thank you, Michelle. I love you, Knife Side. You feed me delicious foods. And we got Yeti Jizz.
Yep.
Oh, that's good stuff.
Perfect. Thanks, man.
Thanks, Christian.